Byron, thank you for leading us this morning and helping us get the most out of these songs that we sing. This morning I missed Dwight. He's preaching out at Rogersville. And also, today's going to be a special day here at Sunset. At the conclusion of this early service, we're going to have the installation of a new elder here to join our existing elders. And so I'm excited personally about that. And I know you'll join with me in praying for our new elder as well as our existing elders. We here at Sunset have been moving through a study on the family. And we're going to be drawing this study to a close here in another week. And as we move down toward the end, we've talked about husbands and wives and parents and little children and discipline. And last week, Dwight preached an excellent sermon about an often neglected aspect of family, our singles. And did an excellent job there talking about that part of our spiritual family. This morning, I want us to look at one of the difficult areas that most families face, and that is those separation years, the years that we call the teenage years, often a time of unrest and even outright rebellion. You know, teenage rebellion is a phenomenon that has come to be expected here among American families, but it is a phenomenon that is almost altogether absent from a number of cultures. In many African cultures, there is no teenage rebellion period in a time of adolescence to adulthood. In many of the Eastern cultures, they don't struggle with teenage rebellion years like Americans often do. And I'll say this, not every teenager in America goes through those rebellious years. It's not something that has to happen. It's not something that we should necessarily expect to happen. It's been going on here in our country for quite a while. We read one early writer, Mark Twain, who documented his approach to that problem. He, of course, has that old familiar solution. He says, when a child turns 13 years of age, you need to nail him inside a wooden barrel and begin feeding him through the knot hole. At age 16, you plug up the knot hole. Now, I wouldn't advocate that. In Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6, the passage that David read for us at the beginning, we have that familiar proverb, train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it. Now, this verse has been a source of great hope for many a parent in the midst of difficult years. It's been also a source of much sorrow and guilt for parents. Parents whose children have not turned out as they hoped, or as they expected, or as they fervently prayed. And many a parent hearing that verse, train up a child in the way he should go, is tormented, asking that old question, where did we go wrong? Now, I want to make a point here, and I've shared this before in classes on parenting and with this church. This verse, Proverbs 22 and verse 6, is a proverb. And the characteristics of all proverbs are true of this verse in that it is a truism. It's never meant to be an absolute rule. That's not the nature of proverbs in the book of Proverbs. They are general truisms. Even godly parents who do a first-class job raising their children in a Christian home can still see that child make poor choices or be influenced by their peers to go off in ways that break the hearts of parents. God created Adam and Eve, and he placed them in a perfect environment, and they still made wrong choices. The best parents in a perfect environment and things still can go wrong. You know, if you look at other Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 21, verse 5 says, "The plans of the diligent lead to profit, as surely as haste leads to poverty." But I've seen a few exceptions to that rule. I've seen people who've worked hard, and still they haven't been very successful financially. I've seen people who acted very foolishly, and they still made money. Now, that's not the general rule. As a truism, the plans of the diligent do lead to profit. As a truism, haste generally does lead to poverty. But that's not an ironclad rule, no more than the proverb in 22:6, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it." You know, teen years are typically the ones where the battles are fought. And it begins early in the teen years. And the war zones can be numerous and they can be hotly contested. Arguments about curfew and about music and about cell phones and about grades and cars and clothes and friends and money, and the list just goes on and on. Almost anything you could imagine arguing over can and does happen in the home during those teenage years. One of the best books I read, a book that was a must-have for Vicki and I as we raised our three girls, was James Dobson's book, Parenting Isn't for Cowards. He also wrote another one called Dare to Discipline for the Younger Years. And that was an indispensable book around our house. But in this book that deals more with the teenage years, Parenting Isn't for Cowards, he says that most parents, as they hit that year 13 and 14 and the turmoil begins to come and they begin to see the challenges and the problems, they imagine it's going to get worse and worse and worse, and it's like a canoe going down a river and it hits the rapids and they get increasingly difficult, and you imagine that just a few more yards down that river there's a big waterfall and the kids are going to go right off the edge and they're going to be lost. But he says that's generally not what happens. He says generally as they approach the year 16 it gets worse, 17 it gets worse, but then something magical tends to happen. About the year 17 and 18, the waters begin to grow less turbulent rather than more turbulent. Things begin to get better, and then they move away and they go to college, and every time they come home, things are better. And then finally, you have an adult child that becomes a friend. And what a blessed peace comes over a couple when they discover that tends to be the general rule. Now, during those turbulent years, a parent must pray regularly for wisdom and for patience and for unconditional love to be demonstrated towards that child. You know, one of the lessons we read of as we read through the stories, especially in the Old Testament about families, and there's so many stories of families, is learning not to go to extremes. Don't overreact to situations during those difficult years. And just as dangerously, don't underreact to certain situations. David had one boy that we remember well, Absalom, who was a rebel in the home. He started out as a rebel. He ended his life as a rebel. As his hair was caught in the tree and as he was then killed there, and we remember that plaintive cry of that father over his rebel son, "Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Would that it was I that had died. Oh, Absalom, my son." You know, David had tragedy in his family, and Absalom was not the only rebel. Absalom wanted to take over the kingdom, and he openly defied his father David and got an army to fight against his father David. But later on, when David was an old man, Absalom's little brother, Adonijah, did the same thing. As David lay as an old man, he knew that David planned to make Solomon the king, so he was going to usurp the throne. And he went and had himself declared the king before David was even dead. Adonijah was a rebel too. Adonijah would eventually be killed by his brother Solomon because He again, after Solomon finally became the king, tried to usurp the throne. And so Solomon killed his brother. There's a telling verse in 1 Kings chapter 1 and verse 6 about Adonijah, that rebel child of David. It says his father never interfered with him by asking, "Why do you behave as you do?" You know, it's just as bad to underreact as it is to overreact. And for parents to turn a blind eye and never interfere with their child's misbehavior will breed a rebel just as surely as a parent who overreacts. You know, I think I had my greatest area of struggle as a parent, though, in this area of overreacting. My children would come in, and I tended to just say things and react in ways that I was later regretful of. It's easy to say harsh things and to make ridiculous statements to ground a child for life and just say you're going to do this and you're going to do that, things you can't possibly enforce or do. I had to remind myself, and Vicki helped to remind me, that I'm the adult. I'm the one that had to act like the adult, and you can't expect a child to have the experience or the wisdom that you do, and so you have to maintain that area of balance. But it didn't take much for a few years in my life when my oldest daughter especially would come in, and she would just say something, and it would just send me into orbit. She would come in and say, "You know, Dad, I'm thinking about dropping out of school and backpacking around Europe for a few years." And I would just, my blood pressure would go up, and I would just begin to tell her how dumb that idea was, and we would get into the worst arguments. Later on, I learned through experience, when she would come in and make a statement like that, not to react like that. I'd say, "Oh, well, that sounds like a good idea. Maybe I'll go with you." And I found out that much of what sends parents into orbit is nothing more than your teen thinking out loud. And you don't have to respond and go into battle with every single thing that is said. There's a great verse that I think every parent should keep in mind as they're dealing with teenage children. It's 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 14 and 15. Paul says, "We urge you, brothers," and think of this in terms of a parent and child relationship, "warn those who are idle." That was a big battle we had around our house. "Warn those who are idle. Encourage the timid. Help the weak. Be patient with everyone. Make sure that nobody pays back wrong for wrong, but always try to be kind to each other and to everyone else." What a great rule for Christian parenting, especially during those teenage years. And parents, this may give you hope. It can be a bad thing, but it should be a good thing. Experience is the best tool in your arsenal for getting through those teenagers. Your example is the best tool. There's a little secret, and that is that most teens end up having almost identical values to those values that have been modeled by their parents. They may act like they're going off in a completely different direction, but the general rule, not always, the general rule is that in time, and sometimes it takes many years of living, but the general rule, and I've seen it and you've seen it, parents who have regretted the direction their children have taken, and sometimes it's even after the parents have died and gone, that those children will come right back and they'll follow the same paths that their parents followed. So often that is the case. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 40, we read, "A student is not above his teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. And what you're modeling today, the values you hold, the things that you hold high, are generally going to be the things that ultimately your children will respect and follow." It's like that old song, "Cats in the Cradle." Most children will grow up to be just like us. You know, David had a real problem in this area too. He had a household full of rebel children. Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar, so Absalom killed his half-brother Amnon. Adonijah tried to usurp the throne, so Solomon had him killed. All this incest, all this fratricide that went on right under the roof of David. But you look at David's example. David's sin with Bathsheba. His example, the way he dealt with his children, all of this set the stage for the rebellion that would occur. Others who live godly lives have children that tend to turn out in a different way. So Christian parents, watch your walk. Watch your example. Watch the way you live, the consistency of your Christian life. That is the greatest single parenting tool that you have. Long after they've forgotten what you said, they will remember what you did. And then a third thing is Christian parents who are going through these turbulent years, we need to choose our battles carefully. There will be times when a parent can and must draw a line and say a definitive no. No, you cannot do that. No, that goes against the Christian values of our family, and we're not going to stand idly by and watch you take that step. We can't do that. And so parents have to make that decision at times. I heard about one family who had planned a wonderful family vacation. And they were going to go to Greece, and they were going to take their two teenagers. And one of the boys was constantly giving trouble. In school, he was rebellious. He was making poor grades when he was capable of doing much better. And the parents just laid down a rule, and they said, if you don't change your attitude and begin getting better reports at school, and if you don't bring your grades up, you're not going. You're going to stay with Grandma and Grandpa while the other three of us go over on this nice vacation to Greece. Well, it came down to it, and they got the report cards, and he didn't make the grade. He hadn't made the changes, and that was a hard decision, and that family said no. And he went and stayed with Grandma and Grandpa, and the other three got on the plane, as hard as it was, and they flew off on their vacation, and they sent him a postcard, and they wrote back, and they said, we're standing on this high pinnacle here, a famous mountain in Greece, where the ancients used to throw their defective children off the cliff to their death. Wish you were here. You know, all too often, though, we draw a line in the sand, and we take our fight to the death stance in areas that really do not deserve the heavy artillery. And parents, I had to be reminded. We all have to remind each other. Is it really a biblical mandate that a child's room be completely neat and clean? No, that's what I like. And if it becomes a health issue, that's another matter. But is that absolutely an essential thing? I've discovered, as many parents have, that a child with a messy room at home somehow, miraculously, turned into a child that keeps a very neat house when it's their own. You know, we battle over music and fight over volume, and really loud isn't immoral, it's just uncomfortable, and it has to be worked out and negotiated. Dumb music is not immoral. The only thing about music that parents need to be concerned about are the lyrics, the words. Those are the important things, and there are songs that are immoral, and they shouldn't be listened to. But dumb music isn't necessarily immoral. I mean, I grew up listening to songs like Jeremiah was a Bullfrog. So there's dumb music out there. There's going to be enough battles that are really worth fighting over without entering into death combat over issues that don't really matter. Paul's advice for spiritual families, I think, applies equally to families that have teenagers. Listen to these words in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 2. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. That's what it takes, bearing with one another in love. And then one thing that my children said to me, they said, you always say no before you even hear everything that we're saying. I mean, they'd come to me with requests, and I got into a reflex response of just saying no. I think it's important to understand that no is not the most godly word in the vocabulary of a parent. There are things that we can say yes to, and we all want someone, when we come to them, rather than acting negatively toward anything we say, we want We want people to act excited and interested in what we've got to share. We need to be parents who want to say yes versus ones who want to say no all the time. Your teens will sense a difference when you listen carefully to them. In Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, the prophet says, "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse." You know, that's the prayer of the prophet. That's the prayer of every Christian parent, that the hearts of the children and the fathers will be turned toward one another. That's possible in Christ, and it's possible when we allow God's Word to set the standard by which we live. We're going to sing a song of invitation here in just a moment, and this is a time that we use here in this congregation for several things. It's a time if families would like to be identified with this congregation, if they can come. Sometimes we just have families stand where they are and welcome them if they'll tell us that they're wanting to be part of this church family. It's a time when people can come and ask for prayer, ask for wisdom, ask for help from their spiritual family, and we always delight to pray for each other in this, at this time. It's a time when people can come who have made a decision that they want Jesus Christ to be the Lord and the Master of their life. It's a time where they can come and confess Him before this group and be baptized into Christ. If you're subject to the Lord in this way, or would like to come for any of these reasons, we want to invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.